Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Earnings is the secret password to the business news of the day. The Federal Reserve made a boatload of money last year. We will explain how. Companies started reporting their earnings this week. They are not bringing in quite as much as the Fed is. And NBC is hoping that Leno back in late night is going to mean better days ahead. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 12th of January, and it is good to have you with us. For all the criticism that Ben Bernanke has gotten for the way the Federal Reserve handled the financial crisis, and he has gotten plenty, you got to give him this. The guy does deliver to the bottom line. The Federal Reserve made a record profit last year, turned a nice deposit of about $46 billion back to the Treasury Department. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to explain the Fed's investment strategy.
The Fed usually invests in things like U.S. Treasury bonds, not glamorous, but safe. Last year was different. The Fed bought things no one else wanted. You know, those toxic assets like mortgage-backed securities, highly risky investments backed by pools of mortgages. Economist Axel Merck of Merck Mutual Funds says the strategy paid off.
The Federal Reserve has been buying specific securities that were deeply undervalued during the crisis and have now appreciated in value.
During the financial crisis, the Fed, in essence, printed money and used it to buy assets that pay interest. It's a pretty cool business model. Imagine if the Fed didn't have to worry about the economy, if it could invest Goldman Sachs-style, high risk, purely for profit. Douglas Diamond is an economist at the University of Chicago.
So if they could sort of run the Fed as a hedge fund, which some people have accused them of doing recently, they could be the most profitable hedge fund because they could borrow more money than anybody else.
But they could lose more money, too. Vincent Reinhardt is a former Fed official who's now at the American Enterprise Institute. He says the Fed isn't crowing about its profits because of what could happen when it has to sell some of its investments.
In Washington, normally you'd have a band and a parade. Well, they don't want to draw attention to the profits they made, because if it comes time to actually shrink their balance sheet, they very well may have to post losses.
And another thing, the Fed's profit is dwarfed by how much the government has spent to shore up the economy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Much like the Fed, corporate America is in the throes of profit reports. Aluminum producer Alcoa kicked things off after the closing bell yesterday by posting a worse than expected loss for the last quarter of 2009. Overall, though, best guesses are we'll see the first growth in quarterly profits in almost 3 years, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
During the second and third quarters of 2009, corporate profits were better than expected, but mostly because companies were cutting costs and slashing jobs. Mark Eibel is a strategist with Russell Investments. He says this time around, investors want to see those companies actually bringing in money.
Last quarter, you were okay if you just hit your earnings number. This quarter, we don't want to see it just from cost cutting. We want to see revenue growth, and we want to see more companies showing revenue growth than the previous one.
But even if companies do show growth, investors shouldn't get too excited. After all, it's easy to look good compared to the end of 2008, when it looked like the economy might collapse. And some companies are going out of their way to make sure investors don't get ahead of themselves. Game maker Electronic Arts cut its forecast for the coming year. Alec Young with Standard & Poor's expects to see more companies set the bar low.
Let the market get its head around some fairly modest expectations, only to see those beaten. That, I think, would be a better situation than to have investors hoping for more than is realistic, only to be disappointed down the road.
It's not just investors who care. Quincy Crosby with Prudential Financial says companies that don't make profits can't create jobs.
Once we see that companies are turning the corner and really earning money, at some point they have to hire.
But S&P's Alec Young says it may be April, when this quarter's numbers start coming in, before we see how well companies are really doing. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Earnings at NBC Universal over the past year or so have been lackluster at best, and that accounts for Jay Leno saying this on his show last night.
I take pride in one thing. I leave NBC Primetime the same way I found it, a complete disaster. So that's...
Ouch, right? NBC, as you know, is moving Leno back to late night, but that is really only the half of it. In a statement this afternoon, the other interested party, that would be Conan O'Brien, finally let his desires be known, and they categorically do not include hosting The Tonight Show if it starts at midnight. So to talk about where NBC goes from here, we've got Matea Gold with us. She covers television for the Los Angeles Times. It's good to have you here.
My pleasure.
So here we have the answer to evening television, right, with the Jay Leno show at 10 o'clock, but maybe not. What the heck happened?
Yeah, it turned out to be an experiment that did not work so well. NBC thought that this would be a gamble that would pay off. They would not have to pay the huge production costs of those expensive scripted dramas, and instead they could just strip Jay Leno's show across the 10 o'clock hour. But viewers decided it really wasn't what they wanted to see, and even though NBC said it financially, it was still working out for them. The low audience that it was delivering to the local newscasts for NBC affiliates was just a real problem, and the affiliates cried foul and said, we can't deal with this anymore. We need a better lead-in.
The events of the past couple of days are the result of a process that NBC CEO Jeff Zucker set in motion a number of years ago. Moving Jay, getting Conan the Tonight Show, all of this stuff. And I have to ask, in light of all that has befallen NBC television in the last couple of years, including now this, why does Jeff Zucker still have a job?
You know, it's a question a lot of people in the industry ask. I think most analysts we speak to note that despite the fact that NBC primetime has not fared very well under him, he still has managed to deliver levels of profitability that really please his superior. So that's really what has kept him riding high all these years. And, you know, he makes the argument that he had to take a big swing to try to reimagine a business in a time when, you know, broadcast television is under the same threat as a lot of traditional media, and he was trying to rethink it.
Well, see, he is now left with 5 hours of primetime television to fill when Jay Leno moves. What's he going to do?
Well, NBC is really scrambling now. They had scaled back their development significantly. One of the arguments that Jeff Zucker and other executives made is that the pilot system was broken, so they hadn't ordered up a lot of new pilots. They're now sending that into overdrive. They announced a slate of, you know, 7 new shows as part of their early development slate, and they come from big names like Jerry Bruckheimer, and I think they're really trying to send the signal back to Hollywood that we're back in the television scripted business and we're here to stay, at least for now.
Is it fair to say that the model that they were experimenting with Leno, that is to say programming on the cheap for economic reasons, that one's just dead and it's going to be expensive to do television now?
Well, you know, I mean, I think in the short term, at least, most analysts tell us that we're not going to see another network take a gamble like this again, that it seems like as much as the viewership is eroding from traditional broadcast networks, those scripted dramas still do bring in the audience. And there didn't seem to be an appetite for a stripped comedy variety program at that hour.
It does kind of seem like must-see TV was just a long, long time ago, doesn't it?
A different eon ago, a different age ago.
Matea Gold, she's a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, covers television entertainment, she does. Matea, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
On Wall Street today, traders snapped out of the doldrums they've been in. Would have been better if they hadn't, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all the books and special reports and stories that have been written about the financial crisis, the official government investigation doesn't get started until tomorrow. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission holds its first meeting in Washington in the morning. But we have been down this road before. During the Great Depression, the Pecora Commission investigated the Wall Street crash of 1929. And 75 years later, the modern version might be as effective. But commentator John Steele Gordon says don't count on it.
The Pecora Commission was frankly a bit of a media circus. At one point, a photographer plopped a midget into the lap of J.P. Morgan Jr., and the resulting photograph was on the front page of nearly every newspaper in the country. But the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 and the Securities Acts of 1933 and 34 were deeply influenced by the Commission's investigation and findings. Thus, the Pecora Commission helped shape the new regulatory framework that was among the most important factors in bringing about the great prosperity of post-war America. It was therefore, circus or no, a great success. I'm afraid the same won't be said for the inquiry commission that starts tomorrow. In the 1920s, Wall Street had become very corrupt. In the recent crisis, while Wall Street certainly made big mistakes, federal regulatory failure and corruption are as much to blame as Wall Street greed and bungling. For example, mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were at the very heart of this mess. Theoretically independent, profit-seeking corporations, they are headquartered in Washington, D.C., largely managed by politicians, not businessmen, and deeply corrupt, with subprime mortgages reported as prime and books cooked to produce executive bonuses. And they were woefully underregulated. The government has had to pour $400 billion into Fannie and Freddie to cover their losses, eight times as much as was lost in the failure of Enron. Will they be as deeply investigated as Wall Street banks and rating agencies? Here's an indication. The commission is charged to, quote, examine the causes of the current financial and economic crisis in the United States. Specifically, it is to look at 22 areas. But while 19 of these have to do with Wall Street's failures, only three deal with regulatory failure, one with Fannie and Freddie. And while the commission is supposed to be bipartisan, six of the commissioners were appointed by Democratic leaders, only four by Republicans. So don't expect Representative Barney Frank and Senator Chris Dodd to be summoned to testify anytime soon. Frankly, it looks to me like the fix is in.
Historian John Steele Gordon's most recent book is called An Empire of Wealth. We would like to hear from you. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. You wouldn't think Mexican food needs much help in this country. If you've got a hankering for it, there's no shortage of restaurants out there to choose from. But the Mexican government doesn't think a lot of what is served here is all that real. So it helped set up a new trade association to encourage the spread of more authentic cuisine. Sylvia Maria Gross from KCUR in Kansas City went to the first meeting of that trade association to get a taste.
At this conference, one of the key sessions is lunch. Chef Patricia Cabrera is feeding a choosy crowd, 150 restaurateurs. As she chops a pile of garlic, she tells me about the meal she's preparing.
One avocado salad, and also I will have a callo de hacha cocktail. This is scallops cocktail. You want to try a little bit of the tequila dressing?
Sure.
When Cabrera opened her restaurant in Portland, Oregon 6 years ago, she didn't want to make the standard Tex-Mex enchilada smothered with cheese.
This Mexican food that I see in this country is not the Mexican food that I grew up. I tried to introduce the flavors that I grew up.
Mexican food is now the most popular ethnic food in the U.S., bigger than Italian or Chinese. The 90,000 or so Mexican restaurants include chains like Taco Bell and Chipotle, as well as mom-and-pop joints. And even at restaurants owned by Mexican immigrants, the food isn't always authentic. But the Mexican government is trying to change that. Jacob Prado is consul in Kansas City.
Mexican food, the Mexican gastronomy, is part of our national identity. I mean, all the Mexican restaurants in this country are actually ambassadors of our culture.
The Mexican government helped found the Mexican Restaurant Association, or MERA. It now has more than 1,000 members, ranging from hip San Francisco bistros to taquerias in Arkansas. Its members know there's a growing demand for authenticity. MERA convention organizer Angela Galvis says the association is trying to help them keep up.
The super chefs are coming here to actually tell a restaurateur, place a couple of tortilla chips and a little color and a tomato in a certain way, and you can charge $1 more because of the presentation.
This is para servir el taco, una rueda de hoja de plátano.
In a kitchen upstairs, Mexico City chef Jorge Alvarez shows how he cuts banana leaves in circles to line the plates for his cochinita pibil, a slow-roasted pork dish from the Yucatan Peninsula.
Yo creo que cuando cambias de país, algo que se pierde es el sazón.
Alvarez says U.S.-based chefs forget the flavors of their home country, and it's hard to find key ingredients. MERA helps members locate and negotiate better prices for these products. It helps Mexican exports, too. At his restaurant in Kansas City, Arturo Cabral serves up traditional seafood specialties, mole sauce, and high-end tequilas. But he also has basic Tex-Mex on the menu.
You have to give what's in demand. So Kansas City loves that kind of food. I mean, I love that kind of food. So you have to have that.
Other countries have tried to raise the status of their cuisine abroad. A few years ago, the Italians tried to reclaim spaghetti and pizza from their cheesy American cousins. But whatever the cuisine, restaurant owners know they have to balance the ideal of culinary excellence with the tastes of diners here in the U.S. In Kansas City, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross for Marketplace.
Coming up, surgery centers slice into a new market.
This is the ultimate cherry picking, and the cherries are the patients who are most profitable.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up a 1/3% today. 36 points ended at 10,627. The NASDAQ forfeited 1 3/10%. 30 points closed at 2,282. The S&P 500 lost 9/10%. 10 points ended the day at 1136. Financial firms fell across the board on concerns that the government may impose new taxes on the big banks. Bank of America reversed more than 3 1/3% today. Citigroup wasn't far behind with a 3% loss. Alcoa's disappointing start to the earnings season yesterday and announced results after the bell. That drove stocks lower today, especially as it happens Alcoa. It sheared off 11%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.71%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a company that provides insurance solutions for women who have faced breast cancer. Information at massmutual.com/women. Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 436 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of current economic conditions, the first for 2010. The House Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on China. And Emmy Award-winning actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus turns 49. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Almost any place you go in this world, you can find a little slice of America because we export virtually every part of our culture, television and movies, fashion, music and food. In his new book, Crazy Like Us, author Ethan Waters makes the case that we export our mental illnesses, too. Ethan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mental illness seems a very personal thing, I guess, to be exporting to other countries. How does that work?
Well, it's interesting. Cultures shape the experience of mental illness, whether you talk about depression or something like PTSD. How we think about it and how we treat it actually shapes the experience itself. So when we, as the globalizing culture in America, export our notions of mental illness in terms of how we treat it and how we think about it, we are inadvertently shaping those illnesses as well. And what we are doing by exporting our notions of mental illness around the world is we're homogenizing the way the world goes mad.
And it's your theory that it's the drug companies that are doing this.
Certainly, that is one of the key forces. In the book, I tell the story of how GlaxoSmithKline took Paxil to Japan at the beginning of the century. You know, they began to gather this knowledge about how to change Japan's notions of depressions. And they even enlisted some of these cross-cultural psychiatrists who understand how culture shapes mental illness. They enlisted them in the process. And they taught them to change that idea of states of melancholy can be almost transcendent states of being into this idea that states of melancholy were a mental illness. And bam, they had a tremendous market for their drug, and they're now selling $1 billion worth of Paxil a year.
This is kind of a bald thing to say, but if you try to remain value neutral about this, it makes economic sense for these drug companies, some of which are American, some of which are British, some of which are European. Makes sense for them to try to explore other markets, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the book documents how these executives at these companies talk about the evolution of other cultures. So they talk about China being 10 years behind Japan and Japan being 5 years behind America. And they become very good at going from culture to culture, changing notions of sadness, for instance, into ideas of depression. And they assume that we're at the head of the evolutionary tree and that other cultures need to become more like us.
You know, you note fairly early on in this book that it's the American psychiatric and mental health community that actually literally writes the book on mental illnesses that are used around the world. The DSM is called.
Yeah, the DSM, the current edition is the DSM-4, and it's an enormously influential book in the world of psychiatry. It is, and people think of it as sort of the field guide to the human psyche. Unfortunately, what cross-cultural psychiatrists and medical anthropologists have to say about this is that these are actually culturally shaped illnesses that you find in the DSM, and that those don't apply to everywhere in the world. And the trick is, if you go to another culture with the DSM and you're looking only for the symptoms, say with post-traumatic stress disorder, you're likely to find a cluster of those symptoms, but it keeps you from looking at the broad spectrum of, say, a psychological reaction to trauma.
I was struck to read that your wife is a psychiatrist.
My wife is a very good psychiatrist, so I'm not in a blanket way against the use of these drugs. Certainly, to the extent that they can relieve suffering, they should not be denied to the rest of the world. My case is that we need to understand the cultural ideas that come with them, the ideas of the human self, the ideas of that shape these expressions of these illnesses, and understand that we can perhaps share our medical knowledge without imposing our cultural ideas about the human mind, because we erase the diversity of the world's understanding of the mind, I think, to our peril.
Ethan Waters, his new book is called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Ethan, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
There's a whole infrastructure that comes along with healthcare in this country, not just the billing and the bureaucracy, but the actual places you go to get care. For decades, conventional wisdom has been that if you needed an operation, you had to go to the hospital, even for one-day procedures. Outpatient surgery centers have changed that. They can be easier for patients, less expensive for insurers, and big moneymakers for the doctors who often own them. But the boom in those surgery centers has hospitals feeling a whole lot of pain. Kerry Grins reports from WHYY in Philadelphia.
This is our pre-op combined and recovery area, PACU area as we call it. It has 17 beds.
Adam Hauser is an anesthesiologist. He wears blue scrubs and one of those little blue scrub caps as he shows off his surgery center.
My anesthesia machine. Love my machine here. My anesthesia cart. Here's an operating room bed.
Hauser works a few days a week at a large suburban hospital. Most days, he's here running the surgery center at Brinton Lake, which does pretty much everything.
Orthopedics, ear, nose, and throat, ophthalmology, pain management services, urology, general
and
surgery,
a lot of procedures like knee surgeries that are popular among baby boomers, a huge, well-insured market. Hauser started the center 4 years ago after realizing that many patients could be treated less expensively outside the hospital. Attracting surgeons was easy, he says, because outpatient centers offer simpler scheduling and faster turnaround times. Hauser says Brinton Lake doubled its business in the last 2 years.
We haven't actually done the whole budget for next year yet, but we're probably going to anticipate 15 to 20% margin next year.
Profits like that are typical and have been behind a small explosion of these ambulatory surgery centers, or ASCs as they're called. With hundreds of new centers opening each year, some states have begun regulating their growth.
These ambulatory centers tend to be very profitable because they can do high volume with low overhead on well-insured patients.
Robert Field is a healthcare regulation expert at Drexel University Law School. He says those surgeries are also very important to hospitals. The profits subsidize their most expensive departments, such as burn units, ICUs, and emergency rooms. And that's creating stiff competition for surgical outpatients.
This is the ultimate cherry picking, and the cherries are the patients who are most profitable.
With every new surgery center that pops up, hospitals lose out. Richard Keenan is the chief financial officer of Valley Hospital in Ridgewood, New Jersey. He says surgery cases earn the majority of the hospital's revenue.
For the first time in the history of Valley Hospital, we did fewer surgical cases in 2009 than we did in 2008 than we did in 2007. So we have seen the erosion.
And he means that literally.
That says ambulatory surgery center. Right there.
So right within view of your office.
Right.
And there are five more centers in adjacent towns. Surgery centers might be the thorn in hospitals' sides, but they save money for the healthcare system, a primary goal of health reform. Kathy Bryant is the president of the Ambulatory Surgery Center Association.
Right now, Medicare pays ASCs about 59% of what they pay hospitals for performing the same procedure. So there's a great deal of savings that Medicare can achieve.
Even Richard Keenan at Valley Hospital agrees.
It's hard to argue that it's a bad thing.
Hospitals are taking notice. More and more of them are teaming up with doctors to open their own outpatient centers. In fact, the Brinton Lake Surgery Center, run by Dr. Hauser, is partially owned by the hospital he works for. In Philadelphia, I'm Carrie Grenz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, an observation that when we talk about taxpayers owning a chunk of the insurance company AIG or the Federal Reserve investing our money in rescuing the financial industry, we're only using those words own and our in the loosest possible way. We learned today that at AIG's request, last year the Securities and Exchange Commission agreed to keep some of the most controversial details of AIG's government bailout secret until 2018. And while you're mulling that one over, the Federal Reserve continues to fight a Freedom of Information lawsuit brought by Bloomberg News. Today, the Fed's lawyers asked a federal appeals court to let it keep quiet on the identities of the banks it bailed out with its lending programs. It's all on a need-to-know basis, I guess, and just because you own it doesn't mean you need it. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 36 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ down 30 points, 1.33%. The S&P 500 down 10 points, 0.9%. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this broadcast, paying prisoners with stimulus money.
The idea that we are sending stimulus dollars to prison industries really flies in the face of the unemployment lines that we're seeing across the country.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.